Hello everyone, this is Dr. Sudeep Mohan Das, the co-founder and managing director of iFirst International. Welcome to the program where we speak to non-profit experts, so people have a lot of experience in this area. Today I have with me George Wolander, an old friend but somebody who's had a lot of experience in a particular area which we're going to discuss today. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Sudeep. Great to be here.
So, I have, just like every time I interview many people, three questions for you. But we'll see how we go through this journey. And I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. My first question to you is, I understand you did a lot of work when you were in Canada.
Right.
And that was for a period of time, working for an NGO, focusing on the Inuit community.
Right, that's right.
Care to share a little bit about that?
Okay. I actually lived in the Canadian Arctic for about 20 years, from about 1985 to 2007. And I originally went up as a young man, as a management trainee with a department store chain, the Hudson's Bay Company. And I worked with them for a couple of years, and then moved over to another retail chain and worked with them for a couple of years. So that I did that until about 1991, and then based on the experience that I had developed in retail, the business experience, I got hired on by the territorial government. So here in Malaysia, the equivalent would be the state government, and I got hired on as an economic development officer. The environment that I was living in, Nunavut, is a territory of about a million square miles, and within this million square miles, there's about 25 different communities, none of which can be reached other than by air. So they're all very isolated. The smallest community is maybe 150 people. The largest, when I was there, was about 3,000 people. And 95% of the population in the communities that I lived in were Inuit, formerly known as Eskimos.
Ah, so that's interesting. Maybe I'm pretty intrigued by the fact that you said, you know, there were about 25 communities or maybe around that number.
Right.
And they all spread across that huge landscape.
Right.
Were there any mindset or differences in the way their mentality was across these different communities?
Well, the Inuit, they're an indigenous community. So, and they only basically started coming off the land in the 1940s, 1950s. So they still have a very traditional mindset in terms of their thinking. For example, community is more important than individual. The community is more important than the individual. Community rights are more important than individual rights. There's a strong connection to the land. There's a strong belief in spirits. And up until the time that they came off the land, there was a very strong sense of self-sufficiency. For example, the land provided everything that the Inuit needed to live, and food in terms of food, in terms of housing, et cetera, clothing.
That's interesting. So I'm pretty interested in this area whereby, you know, we have a lot of people from the outside come on board and, you know, give their views of how things are, especially when it comes to training or coaching or even mentoring or even giving basic guidelines of what to do, what's best. I'm not so sure whether all this is in the right way to do it or not. But I would like to hear your views. Am I correct to say, you know, that we got to understand the community before we start even telling them what is right and wrong? Am I right to say this? And what are the kind of analogies or stories you can share about this?
Well, I guess when I started out my career in economic development, I worked as a frontline economic development officer for about 7 years, first with the territorial government and then with an NGO. And after that, I actually delivered funding programs for about 4 years. And then after that, I was the executive director of an economic development NGO. In Nunavut. So my experience has been from both the program delivery aspect, you know, working face to face with Inuit, and then also from the strategic point of view in terms of development of an overall policy of how we can best help Inuit with regard to economic development. And then during my time as well, I was involved with a number of local NGOs. For example, community radio is one of my passions. So I was with community radio societies for a number of years. I was on the town council of one of my communities for a year. And I'll tell you, you know, you see a lot of things. And I think most people, when they go to the north, there's different reasons why for people going to the Arctic and living and working among the Inuit. One of them is just a selfish motivation, and a lot of people are hired from southern Canada because the Inuit don't have a lot of the skills in terms of management. They don't have a lot of the technical skills and the education for a lot of the positions. So a lot of hiring is done of southern Canadians. So they come up north, and one of the motivations may be just to line their pockets, make money for their retirement, so they'll stay for about 5 or 10 years, then they'll come out. Another motivation is they'll get hired for a job with the government with the intention of doing good. I don't think anybody, I don't know about here in Malaysia, but I don't think anybody can actually go in nowadays to a community and say, I'm here to help you, I know better than you. It would be political suicide for anybody to do that, and you'd be called out on it straight away. I think there's a genuine, for those that are there to help, it's a genuine belief that they have skills and knowledge that can help Inuit, that can contribute to their betterment. The problem is that you've got a government, number one, that does things top down. So they usually do a lot of the consulting with communities gets done after the fact. They'll come up with a program and then they'll launch it without doing a whole lot of the groundwork.
And what do you mean by that groundwork?
Well, consulting with the communities to say, is this something that will work for you in your community? The way that we've designed it, are the eligibility criteria to access funding, for example, to start up a business?
You would think it's not rocket science. You would have to talk to the people, the very people you're going to be working with.
You would think so, but I think they're still very much... there's very much of a mindset. When government first came in, and when the first non-Inuit came up to the north, the priests and the priests, the missionaries, the traders, the police, Inuit were very much sort of in awe and very respectful of these people. So there's a bit of a gap, and even now. You know, the non-Inuit or the whites, quote unquote, are still seen in that position of knowing better, even though they don't. And Inuit will talk behind their backs and laugh at them. They won't do it directly, you know, because they don't want to confront.
Face saving.
Exactly, face saving. But you know, they know that they don't have all the answers. But you know, what can they do? They're government. So government comes in, and it's assumed that government has all the answers, you know, that they know best. And so consulting people, you can do the consultation, but there's a limited amount of money to go around. And so if you were to try and tackle everything that the people wanted, there would be a laundry list a mile long.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, so government has to pick and choose, and unfortunately. They don't pick well, and I think another thing that happens is that governments get bad advice from experts and consultants from southern Canada.
Right. So that, I guess this is in many ways a universal problem. So let's just come down now to Malaysia. You've been here for a while, and you're also familiar with the issues here in Malaysia. I know there are many young talents who are finding it hard to find jobs. That they desire for, right? And I take this in the context of wherever they are in Malaysia.
Mm.
And since you've had the experience working with communities, you'll understand, you know, the challenges and difficulties. in many cases, I hear it's because the reasons why they can't find jobs is because of soft skills. Some say it's because, you know, the education was not good enough, or in many ways it's maybe their background. Do these talents that are out there require a big transformation or mind shift, or is it at the recruitment level that is lacking something that is not being able to find those gems, you know?
Right.
What's your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that the biggest failure is not these young people. These young people are brilliant. The biggest failure is the education system, and it's not just here in Malaysia. I've seen it back in Canada as well. And for the life of me, I cannot understand why, in this day and age, why we don't have career counselors in the schools to guide young people in terms of, you know, future education paths and future careers. Not just the young people, but to guide the parents as well. Because parents are the ones that have a big say in the education of their children, and a big say in what kind of careers they want their children to have. Oh, you must be a doctor, you must be a lawyer, you must be a teacher. Regardless of what the young person wants, regardless of what their aptitudes and motivations are and their skill sets. So I think that we have failed our young people by not having career counselors in the schools to provide guidance to both the students and the parents. So that's number one. These young people are lost. They're pursuing courses of education that their parents want that they don't necessarily want. So you've got these young people graduating with fantastic degrees in biotechnology, biochemistry, electrical engineering, and yet these young people, they don't want to have anything to do with the subject. And the other point is that they're being prepared for careers where there's no demand for them. Especially if they're just coming out of university with an undergrad degree, and you've got employers wanting, you know, 5-7 years worth of experience. How are they going to get the experience if no one will give them a break? So that's the same the world over as well.
And this is primarily not in the urban sector. This would be more outside, right?
This is everywhere. It's a failure of the national education system. Mm-hmm. Again, not just in Malaysia. I've seen it in Canada as well. Yeah. We just do not prepare our young people for the careers that are out there. We don't put them through any kind of testing to see what their aptitudes or skills or interests are. We don't nurture them.
But are you talking at the school level or the university level?
I'm talking both. Actually, it should really start in the primary schools. You know, from primary school, then secondary school, and lastly, if you haven't had any of it done, surely by the time you hit university, you know that should happen.
And I guess this also happens if you come from, in this case, let's say the B40,
right?
And you live in the more rural areas, you're more distant from a lot of those opportunities out there. So the career counselor, as you put it, or whatever, becomes even more important, right? To expose them.
I would say yes, because not every career opportunity is going to require a university education, and if you want to stay close to your kampung, close to your family, you don't want to leave. There's only a limited number of occupations in the community, and so what are those occupations? A lot of them are the skilled and semi-skilled occupations, the ones that would benefit from TVET rather than university degrees.
And is there any training for career counselors? I mean, is there any formalized program to train these career counselors? I mean, my assumption is a lot of them go by what they're exposed or what they read, but have they gone to any formalized, do you know? I mean,
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Would that be something that would be very useful for them to expose these opportunities and put them through a case study? And
yeah, I think that would be very beneficial, because all the career counselors know, all they see are the same things that the parents see in the papers, and all they can guide the young people to are the careers that they're aware of. You know, they may not be aware of 21st century careers and what's required in terms of education and work to get there.
Well, thanks very much, George. We've come to the end of the session. You've been very insightful and you've shared a lot. Are there any parting words you'd like to just say before we end?
Okay, getting back to the young people.
Yeah.
You know, everybody says that the youth are our future, but we really don't pay enough attention to them. Every generation has this problem. You know, we look at our young people and we tell them, oh, you must do this, you must do that. As parents, we say, you must do this, you must do that to avoid this kind of pain or to achieve success, yada, yada, yada. But what examples do our young people have? Our young people have no life experience. The only life experience that they see is the life experience that we have. And you know what? We're not perfect and we make a lot of mistakes. So I think it's natural for every generation to look at their parents and go, oh my God, I don't want to be like that. You know, I don't want to be like my dad, who worked for the same employer for 30 years before he finally retired and had this pittance of a pension, and he was never there because he had to work like a dog, and you know he missed all these kinds of things. So I don't want to be like him. So I think that kind of thing is natural, and you know you look at the Gen Ys, the millennials today. They don't want to be tied down to the same kind of jobs that we have, and yet as parents we kind of have those expectations of them. So I think what we need to do is, rather than looking at the problems of youth, we need to be looking at youth as assets, and we need to be looking at all the positives.
Okay, so thank you very much, George. Really appreciate your having you on this program.
You're most welcome.
So with that, all those who are interested in listening to this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com.